Umber Night by Carolyn Ives Gilman. Narrated by Jennifer O'Donnell.
There is a note from my great-grandmother in the book on my work table, they tell me. I haven't opened it. Up to now, I've been too angry at her whole generation, those brave colonists who settled on dust and left us here to pay the price. But lately, I've begun to feel a little disloyal. Not to her, but to my companions on the journey that brought me the book and gave me the choice whether to read it or not. What exactly am I rejecting here? The past or the future? It was autumn, a long, slow season on dust. It wasn't my first autumn, but I'd been too young to appreciate it the first time. I was coming back from a long ramble to the north, with the Makdu Mountains on my right and the great horizon of the endless plain to my left. I could not live without the horizon. It puts everything in perspective. It is my soul's home. Sorry, I'm not trying to be offensive. As I said, it was autumn. All of life was seeding, and the air was scented with lost chances and never agains. In our region of dust, most of the land vegetation is of the dry, bristly sort, with the largest trees barely taller than I am, huddling in the shade of cliffs. But the plants were putting on their party best before umber night. Big white blooms on the bad dog bushes and patches of bitter berries painting the arroyos orange. I knew I was coming home when a black fly bit me. Some of the organisms we brought have managed to survive. Insects, weeds, lichen. They spread a little every time I'm gone. It's not a big victory, but it's something. The dog started barking when I came into the yard in front of Feynman Habitat, with my faithful buggy tagging along behind me. The dogs never remember me at first, and always take fright at the sight of Buggy. A door opened, and Namja looked out.
"Me Chico's back," she shouted,
and pretty soon there was a mob of people pouring out of the fortified cave entrance. It seemed as if half of them were shorter than my knees. They stared at me as if I were an apparition, and no wonder. My skin was burned dark from the UV, except around my eyes where I wear goggles, and my hair and eyebrows had turned white. I must have looked like Grandmother Winter. "Quite a crop of children you raised while I was gone," I said to Namja. I couldn't quite match the toddlers to the babies I had left. "Yes," she said. "Times are changing." I didn't know what she meant by that, but I would find out. Everyone wanted to help me unpack the buggy, so I supervised. I let them take most of the sample cases to the labs, but I wouldn't let anyone touch the topographical information. That would be my winter project. I was looking forward to a good hibernate, snug in a warm cave, while I worked on my map of dust. The cargo doors rumbled open, and I ordered Bucky to park inside, next to his smaller siblings, the utility vehicles. The children loved seeing him obey, as they always do. Bucky has an alternate career as playground equipment when he's not with me. I hefted my pack and followed the crowd inside. There's always a festive atmosphere when I first get back. Everyone crowds around, telling me news and asking me where I went and what I saw. This time they presented me with the latest project of the food committee, an authentic glass of beer. I think it's an acquired taste, but I acted impressed. We had a big celebratory dinner in the refectory. As a treat, they grilled fillets of chickens and fish, now plentiful enough to eat. The youngsters liked it, but I've never been able to get used to meat. Afterwards, when the parents had taken the children away, a group of adults gathered around my table to talk. By then, I had noticed a change. My own generation had become the old-timers, and the young adults were taking an interest in what was going on. Members of the governing committee were conspicuously absent.
"Don't get too comfortable,"
Hakon said to me in a low tone. "What do you mean?" I said. Everyone exchanged a look. It was Namja who finally explained. The third cargo capsule from the homeworld is going to land at Newton's Eye in about 650 hours. But I stopped when I saw they didn't need me to tell them the problem. The timing couldn't have been worse. Umber Night was just around the corner. Much as we needed that cargo, getting to it would be a gamble with death. I remember how my mother explained Umber Night to me as a child.
There's a bad star in the sky, Michiko.
We didn't know it was there at first, because there's a shroud covering it. But sometimes, in winter, the shroud pulls back, and we can see its light. Then we have to go inside, or we would die. After that, I had nightmares in which I looked up at the sky, and there was the face of a corpse hanging there, covered with a shroud. I would watch in terror as the veil would slowly draw aside, revealing rotted flesh and putrid gray jelly eyes, glowing with a deadly unlight that killed everything it touched. I didn't know anything then about planetary nebulae or stars that emit in the UV and X-ray spectrum. I didn't know we lived in a double star system, circling a perfectly normal G-class star with a very strange, remote companion. I had learned all that by the time I was an adolescent, and Umber finally rose in our sky. I never disputed why I had to spend my youth cooped up in the cave habitat trying to make things run. They told me then, you'll be all grown up with kids of your own before Umber comes again. Not true. All grown up, that part was right. No kids. A dog was nudging my knee under the table, and I needed her velvet ears. I was glad the pro-dog faction had won the great dog debate when the colony had split on whether to reconstitute dogs from frozen embryos. You feel much more human with dogs around. So what's the plan? I asked. As if in answer, the tall, stooped figure of Anselm Thune came into the refectory and headed toward our table. We all fell silent.
The committee wants to see you, Mick, he said.
There are committees for every conceivable thing in Feynman, but when someone says, the committee, capital C, it means the governing committee. It's elected, but the same people have dominated it for years because no one wants to put up with the drama that would result from voting them out. Just the mention of it put me in a bad mood. I followed Anselm into the meeting room, where the five committee members were sitting around a table. The only spare seat was opposite Chairman Colby, so I took it. He has the pale skin of a lifelong cave dweller, and thin white hair fringing his bald head.
Did you find anything useful?
He asked as soon as I sat down. He's always thought my roving is a waste of time because none of my samples have produced anything useful to the colony. All I ever brought back was more evidence of how unsuited this planet is for human habitation. I shrugged. We'll have to see what the lab says about my biosamples. I found a real pretty geothermal region. He grimaced at the word pretty, which was why I'd used it. He was an orthodox rationalist and considered aesthetics to be a gateway drug to superstition.
You'll fit in well with these gullible young animists we're raising, he said. You and your fairy tales.
I was too tired to argue. You wanted something? I said. Anselm said,
Do you know how to get to Newton's Eye?
Of course I do.
How long does it take?
On foot, about 200 hours. Allow a little more for the buggy, say 220. I could see them calculating. There and back, 440 hours, plus some time to unload the cargo capsule and pack, say 450. Was there enough time? I knew myself how long the nights were getting. Dust is sharply tilted, and at our latitude, Its slow days vary from 10 hours of dark and 90 hours of light in the summer to the opposite in winter. We were past the equinox. The nights were over 60 hours long, what we call N60. Umber already rose about midnight. You could get a sunburn before dawn. But most of its radiation didn't reach us yet because of the cloud of dust, gas, and ionized particles surrounding it. At least, that's our theory about what is concealing the star. I don't suppose the astronomers have any predictions when the shroud will part, I said. That set Colby off.
Shroud my ass. That's a backsliding anti-rationalist term. Pretty soon you're going to have people talking about gods and visions, summoning spirits, and rejecting science.
It's just a metaphor, Colby, I said.
I'm trying to prevent us from regressing into savagery. Half of these youngsters are already wearing amulets and praying to idols.
Once again, Anselm intervened.
There is inherent unpredictability about the star's planetary nebula, he said. The first time, the gap appeared at N64.
That is, when night was 64 hours long.
The second time, it didn't come till N70.
We're close to N64 now, I said.
Thank you for telling us,
Colby said with bitter sarcasm. I shrugged and got up to leave. Before I reached the door, Anselm said,
You better start getting your vehicle in order. If we do this, you'll be setting out in about 400 hours.
Just me? I said incredulously.
You and whoever we decide to send.
The suicide team?
You've always been a bad influence on morale,
Colby said. I'm just calculating the odds, like a good rationalist, I replied. Since I really didn't want to hear his answer to that, I laughed. All I wanted was a hot bath and about 20 hours of sleep. That was my first mistake. I should have put my foot down right then. They probably wouldn't have tried it without me. But the habitat was alive with enthusiasm for fetching the cargo. Already more people had volunteered than we could send. The main reason was eagerness to find out what our ancestors had sent us. You could barely walk down the hall without someone stopping you to speculate about it. Some wanted seeds and frozen embryos, electronic components, or medical devices. Others wanted rare minerals, smelting equipment, better water filtration, or something utterly unexpected. Some miracle technology to ease our starved existence. It was the third and last cargo capsule our ancestors had sent by solar sail when they themselves had set out for dust in a faster ship. Without the first two capsules, the colony would have been wiped out during the first winter when Umber revealed itself. As it is, only 2/3 of them perished. The survivors moved to the cave habitat and set about rebuilding a semblance of civilization. We weathered the second winter better here at Feynman. Now that the third winter was upon us, people were hoping for some actual comfort, some margin between us and annihilation. But the capsule was pre-programmed to drop at the original landing site, long since abandoned. It might have been possible to reprogram it, but no one wanted to try calculating a different landing trajectory and sending it by our glitch-prone communication system. The other option, the wise and cautious one, was to let the capsule land and just leave it sitting at Newton's Eye until spring. But we are the descendants of people who set out for a new planet without thoroughly checking it out. Wisdom? Caution? Not in our DNA. All right, that's a little harsh. They said they underestimated the danger from Umber because it was hidden behind our sun as well as its shroud when they were making observations from the home planet. And they did pay for their mistake. I spent the next 10 hours unpacking, playing with the dogs, and hanging out in the kitchen. I didn't see much evidence of Pagan drumming in the halls, so I asked Namja what bee had crawled up Colby's ass. Her eyes rolled eloquently in response. "Come here," she said. She led me into the warren of bedrooms where married couples slept and pulled out a bin from under her bed, the only space any of us has for sorting private belongings. She dug under a concealing pile of clothes and pulled out a broken tile with a colorful design on the backside. A landscape, I realized as I studied it. A painting of dust. "My granddaughter Marigold did it," Namja said in a whisper. What the younger generation had discovered was not superstition, but art. For two generations, all our effort, all our creativity, had gone into improving the odds of survival. Art took materials, energy, and time we didn't have to spare. But that, I learned, was not why Colby and the governing committee disapproved of it. "They think it's a betrayal of our guiding principle," Namja said.
"Rationalism, you mean?"
She nodded. "Rationalism, that universal ethic for which our parents came here, leaving behind a planet that had splintered into 1,000 warring sects and belief systems. They were high-minded people, our settler ancestors. When they couldn't convince the world they were correct, they decided to leave it and found a new one based on science and reason. And it turned out to be dust. Now, two generations later, Colby and the governing committee were trying to beat back irrationality. They lectured us about wearing jewelry," Namja said.
"Why?"
"It might inflame sexual instincts," she said ironically. "Having a body does that," I said.
"Not if you're Colby, I guess."
"They also passed a resolution against figurines."
"That was their idea of a problem?"
"They were afraid people would use them as fetishes." It got worse. Music and dance were now deemed to have shamanistic origins. Even reciting poetry aloud could start people on the slippery slope to prayer groups and worship. "No wonder everyone wants to go to Newton's Eye," I said. We held a meeting to decide what to do. We always have meetings, because the essence of rationality is that it needs to be contested, also because people don't want responsibility for making a decision. About 200 people crammed into the refectory, everyone old enough to understand the issue. We no longer had a room big enough for all, a sure sign we were outgrowing our habitat. From the way the governing committee explained the options, it was clear that they favored the most cautious one, to do nothing at all, and leave the cargo to be fetched by whoever would be around in spring. I could sense disaffection from the left side of the room, where a cohort of young adults stood together. When Colby stopped talking, a lean, intellectual-looking young man named Anatoly spoke up for the youth party.
"What would our ancestors think of us if we let a chance like this slip by?"
Colby gave him a venomous look that told me this was not the first time Anatoly had stood up to authority.
"They would think we were behaving rationally," he said.
"It's not rational to sit cowering in our cave, afraid of the planet we came to live on," Anatoly argued. "This cargo could revolutionize our lives. With new resources and technology, we could expand in the spring, branch out, and found satellite communities."
Watching the committee, I could tell that this was precisely what they feared. New settlements meant new leaders, perhaps ones like Anatoly, willing to challenge what the old leaders stood for.
"Right now, it's a waste of our resources,"
Anselm said.
"We need to focus everything we have on preparing for Umber Night." "It's a waste of resources not to go," Anatoly countered. "You have a precious resource right here."
He gestured at the group behind him.
"People ready and willing to go now. By spring, we'll all be too old."
Believe it or not,
We don't want to waste you either, said Gwen, a third member of the committee. Although Colby looked like he would have gladly wasted Anatoly without a second thought.
We're willing to take the chance, Anatoly said. We belong here, on this planet. We need to embrace it, dangers and all. We are more prepared now than ever before. Our scientists have invented X-ray shielding fabric and cold suits for temperature extremes. We'll never be more ready.
Well, thank you for your input, Anselm said. Anyone else?
The debate continued, but all the important arguments had been made. I slipped out the back and went to visit Bucky, as if he would have an opinion. They may end up sending us after all, I told him in the quiet of his garage. If only to be rid of the troublemakers. The great announcement came about 20 hours later. The committee had decided to roll the dice and authorize the expedition. They posted the list of 6 names on bulletin boards all over the habitat. I learned of it when I saw a cluster of people around one, reading. As I came up behind them, DeSharma exclaimed emotionally, "Oh, this is just plain cruel." Someone saw me, and DeSharma turned around. "Mick, you've got to bring them all back. You hear?" Then she burst into tears. I read the list then, but it didn't explain DeSharma's reaction. Anatoly was on it, not surprisingly. But in what seemed like a deliberate snub, he was not to be the leader. That distinction went to a young man named Amal. The rest were all younger generation. I'd known them in passing as kids and adolescents, but I'd been gone too much to see them much as adults. It's a mix of expendables and rising stars, Namja explained to me later in private. Anatoly, Seabird, and Davern are all people they're willing to sacrifice for different reasons. Amal and Edie, well, choosing them shows that the committee actually wants the expedition to succeed, but we'd all hate to lose them. I didn't need to ask where I fit in. As far as the committee was concerned, I was in the expendable category. My first impression of the others came when I was flat on my back underneath Bucky, converting him to run on bottled propane. Brisk footsteps entered the garage, and 2 practical boots came to a halt. Mick? A woman's voice said. Under here, I answered. She got down on all 4s to look under the vehicle. Sideways, I saw a sunny face with close-cropped dark brown hair. Hi, she said. I'm Edie. I know, I said. I want to talk, she said.
We're talking.
I mean face to face.
We were face to face, more or less, but I suppose she meant upright, so I slid out from under, wiping my oily hands on a rag. We looked at each other across Bucky's back.
We're going to have a meeting to plan out the trip to Newton's Eye, she said.
Okay.
I had already been planning out the trip for a couple work cycles. It's what I do, plan trips, but normally just for myself. Mick, we're going to be counting on you a lot, she said seriously. You're the only one who's ever been to Newton's Eye, and the only one who's ever seen a winter. The rest of us have lots of enthusiasm, but you've got the experience.
I was impressed by her realism, and I confess it, a little bit flattered. No one ever credits me with useful knowledge. I had been prepared to cope with a flock of arrogant, ignorant kids. Edie was none of those things.
Can you bring a map to the meeting? It would help us to know where we're going.
My heart warmed. Finally, someone who saw the usefulness of my maps.
Sure, I said. I've already been thinking about the food, but camping equipment, we'll need your help on that.
Okay. Her face folded pleasantly around her smile.
The rest of us are a talky bunch, so don't let us drown you out.
Okay. After she told me the when and where of the meeting, she laughed.
and I realized I hadn't said more than two syllables at a time. Still, she left me feeling she had understood. When I arrived at the meeting, the effervescence of enthusiasm triggered my fight-or-flight reflex. I don't trust optimism. I stood apart, arms crossed, trying to size up my fellow travelers. The first thing I realized was that Amal and Edie were an item. They had the kind of companionable, good-natured partnership you see in long-married couples. Amal was a big, relaxed young man who was always ready with a joke to put people at ease, while Edie was a little firecracker of an organizer. I'd expected Anatoly to be resentful, challenging Amal for leadership, but he seemed thoroughly committed to the project, and I realized it hadn't just been a power play. He actually wanted to go. The other two were supposed to be under-contributors, as we call them. Seabird. Yes, her parents named her that on this planet without either birds or seas. Was a plump young woman with unkempt hair who remained silent through most of the meeting. I couldn't tell if she was sulky, shy, or just scared out of her mind. Davern was clearly unnerved and made up for it by being as friendly and anxious to ingratiate himself with the others as a lost puppy looking for a master. Neither Seabird nor Davern had volunteered. But then, neither had I, strictly speaking. Amal called on me to show everyone the route. I had drawn it on a map, a physical map that didn't require electricity, and I spread it on the table for them to see. Newton's Eye was an ancient crater basin, visible from space. To get to it, we would have to follow the Let's Go River down to the Mazy Lakes. We would then cross the Damright Barrens, climb down the winding wall to the Owell Valley, and cross it to reach the old landing site. Coming back, it would be uphill all the way. "Who made up these names?" Anatoly said, studying the map with a frown. "I did," I said, mostly for my mood on the day I discovered things. "I thought the settlers wanted to name everything for famous scientists." "Well, the settlers aren't around anymore," I said. Anatoly looked as if he had never heard anything so heretical from one of my generation. He flashed me a sudden smile, then glanced over his shoulder to make sure no one from the governing committee was listening.
"What will it be like traveling?" Edie asked me.
"Cold," I said.
"Dark."
She was waiting for more, so I said, "We'll be traveling in the dark for three shifts to every two in the light. Halfway through night, umber rises, so we'll have to wear protective gear. That's the coldest time, too. It can get cold enough for CO2 to freeze this time of year. There won't be much temptation to take off your masks."
"We can do it," Anatoly said resolutely.
Davern gave a nervous giggle and edged closer to me.
"You know how to do this, don't you, Mick?"
"Well, yes. Unless the shroud parts and umber night comes, then all bets are off. Even I have never traveled through umber night."
"Well, we just won't let that happen," Edie said.
And for a moment, it seemed as if she could actually make the forces of nature obey. I stepped back and watched while Edie coaxed them all into making a series of sensible decisions. A normal work schedule of 10 hours on, 10 hours off, a division of labor, a schedule leading up to departure. Seabird and Davern never volunteered for anything, but Edie cajoled them into accepting assignments without complaint. When it was over, and I was rolling up my map, Edie came over and said to me quietly,
"Don't let Davern latch onto you. He tries to find a protector, someone to adopt him. Don't fall for it."
"I don't have maternal instincts," I said.
She squeezed my arm. "Good for you."
If this mission were to succeed, I thought, it would be because of Edie. Which is not to say that Amal wasn't a good leader. I got to know him when he came to me for advice on equipment. He didn't have Edie's extrovert flair, but his relaxed manner could put a person at ease, and he was methodical about thinking things through. Together, we compiled a daunting list of safety tents, heaters, cold suits, goggles, face masks, first aid, and other gear. Then, when we realized that carrying all of it would leave Bucky with no room for the cargo we wanted to haul back, we set about ruthlessly cutting out everything that wasn't essential for survival. He challenged me on some things.
Rope? He said skeptically. A shovel?
Rationality is about exploiting the predictable, I said. Loose baggage and a mired down vehicle are predictable. He helped me load up Bucky for the trip out with a mathematical precision, eliminating every wasted centimeter. On the way back, we would have to carry much of it on our backs. I did demand one commitment from Amal. If Umber Night comes, we need to turn around and come back instantly, no matter what, I said. At first, he wouldn't commit himself. Have you ever heard what happened to the people caught outside during the first Umber Night? I asked him. The bodies were found in spring, carbonized like statues of charcoal. They say some of them shed tears of gasoline and burst into flame as soon as a spark hit them. He finally agreed. You see, I wasn't reckless. I did some things right. As right as anyone could have done in my shoes. When we set out just before dawn, the whole of Feynman Habitat turned out to see us off. There were hugs and tears, then waves and good wishes, as I ordered Bucky to start down the trail. It took only 5 minutes for Feynman to drop behind us, and for the true immensity of dust to open up ahead. I led the way down the banks of a frozen rivulet that eventually joined the Let's Go River. As the morning warmed, it would begin to gurgle and splash.
When are we stopping for lunch?
Seabird asked.
You're not hungry already, are you? Edie said, laughing. No. I just want to know what the plan is.
My plan is to walk till we're tired and eat when we're hungry.
I'd rather have a time, Seabird insisted. I want to know what to expect.
No one answered her, so she glowered as she walked. It did not take long for us to go farther from the habitat than any of them had ever been. At first, they were elated at the views of the river valley ahead, but as their packs began to weigh heavier and their feet to hurt, the high spirits faded into dogged determination. After a couple of hours, Amal caught up with me at the front of the line.
How far do we need to go this 10-hour?
We need to get to the river valley. There's no good place to pitch the tent before that.
Can we take a break and stay on schedule?
I had already planned on frequent delays for the first few days, so I said, there's a nice spot ahead. As soon as we reached it, Amal called a halt, and everyone dropped their packs and kicked off their boots. I warned them not to take off their UV filtering goggles. You can't see it, but Umber hasn't set yet. You don't want to come back with crispy corneas. I went apart to sit on a rock overlooking the valley, enjoying the isolation. Below me, a grove of look-through trees gestured gently in the wind, their leaves like transparent streamers. Like most plants on dust, they are gray-blue, not green. Because life here never evolved chloroplasts for photosynthesis, it is all Widdershin's life. Its DNA twirls the opposite direction from ours. That makes it mostly incompatible with us. Before long, Anatoly came to join me.
The valley ahead looks like a good place for a satellite community in the spring, he said. What do you think? Could we grow maize there?
The question was about more than agronomy. He wanted to recruit me into his expansion scheme.
You'd need a lot of shit, I said.
I wasn't being flippant. Dumping sewage was how we had created the soil for the outdoor gardens and fields around Feynman. Here on dust, sewage is a precious, limited resource.
He took my remark at face value. It's a long-range plan. We can live off hydroponics at first.
There's a long winter ahead, I said.
Too long, he said. We're bursting at the seams now, and our leaders can only look backward. That's why the committee has never supported your explorations. They think you're wasting time because you've never brought back anything but knowledge. That's how irrational they are.
He was a good persuader. You know why I like being out here? I said. You have to forget all about the habitat and just be a part of dust.
That means you're one of us,
Anatoly said seriously.
The governing committee, they are all still fighting the battles of the homeworld. We are the first truly indigenous generation. We're part of this planet.
Wait until you've seen more of it before you decide for sure. I thought about Anatoly's farming scheme as we continued on past his chosen site. It would be hard to pull off, but not impossible. I would probably never live to see it thrive. The sun was blazing from the southern sky by the time we made camp on the banks of the Let's Go. Edie recruited Davern to help her cook supper, though he seemed to be intentionally making a mess of things so that he could effusively praise her competence. She was having none of it. Amal and Anatoly worked on setting up the sleeping tent. It was made from heavy, radiation-blocking material. That was one of our lab's best inventions. I puttered around aiming Bucky's solar panels while there was light to collect. And Seabird lay on the ground, evidently too exhausted to move. She sat up suddenly, staring at some nearby bushes.
There's something moving around over there.
I don't think so, I said, since we are the only animal life on dust.
There is, she said tensely.
Well, check it out then. She gave me a resentful look, but heaved to her feet and went to look in the bushes. I heard her voice change to that cooing sing-song we use with children and animals.
Come here, girl. What are you doing here? Did you follow us?
With horror, I saw Sally, one of the dogs from Feynman, emerge from the bushes, wiggling in delight at Seabird's welcome. Oh my God, I exclaimed. The dire profanity made everyone turn and stare. No one seemed to understand. In fact, Edie called out the dog's name, and it trotted over to her and stuck its nose eagerly in the cooking pot. She laughed and pushed it away. Amal had figured out the problem.
We can't take a dog. We don't have enough food. We'll have to send her back.
How exactly? I asked bitterly.
I can take her, Seabird volunteered.
If we allowed that, we would not see Seabird again till we got back.
Don't feed her, Anatoly said.
Both Edie and Seabird objected to that.
We can't starve her, Edie said.
I was fuming inside. I half suspected Seabird of letting the dog loose to give herself an excuse to go back. It would have been a cunning move. As soon as I caught myself thinking that way, I said loudly, "Stop." They all looked at me, since I was not in the habit of giving orders.
Eat first, I said.
No major decisions on an empty stomach. While we ate our lentil stew, Sally demonstrated piteously how hungry she was. In the end, Edie and Seabird put down their bowls for Sally to finish off.
Is there anything edible out here?
Edie asked me. There are things we can eat, but not for the long run, I said. We can't absorb their proteins, and the dog won't eat them if she knows there is better food. Anatoly rethought the situation.
She might be useful. We may need a threat detector.
Or camp cleanup services, Edie said, stroking Sally's back.
And if we get hungry enough, she's food that won't spoil, Anatoly added.
Edie and Seabird objected strenuously. I felt like I was reliving the great dog debate. They weren't old enough to remember it. The arguments had been absurdly pseudo-rational, but in the end it had boiled down to sentiment. Pretty soon someone would say, if the ancestors hadn't thought dogs would be useful, they wouldn't have given us the embryos. Then Seabird said it, and I wanted to groan. Amal was trying to be leaderly and not take sides. He looked at Davern.
Don't ask me, Davern said. It's not my responsibility.
He looked at me then. Of course, I didn't want to harm the dog, but keeping her alive would take a lot of resources. You don't know yet what it will be like, I said. Amal seized on my words.
That's right, he said. We don't have enough information. Let's take another vote in 30 hours.
It was the perfect compromise, the decision to make no decision. Of course, the dog ended up in the tent with the rest of us as we slept. Stupid, stupid. Yes, I know. But also kind-hearted and humane in a way my hardened pioneer generation could not afford to be. It was as if my companions were recovering a buried memory of what it had once been like to be human. The next 10 hours' journey was a pleasant stroll down the river valley, speckled with groves of look-through trees. Umber had set, and the sun was still high, so we could safely go without goggles, the breeze blowing like freedom on our faces. 20 hours of sunlight had warmed the air, and the river ran ice-free at our side. We threw sticks into it for Sally to dive in and fetch. We slept away another 10 hours, and rose as the sun was setting. From atop the hill on which we had camped, we could see far ahead where the Let's Go flowed into the mazy lakes, a labyrinth of convoluted inlets, peninsulas, and islands. In the fading light, I carefully reviewed my maps, comparing them to what I could see. There was a way through it, but we would have to be careful not to get trapped. As night deepened, we began to pick our way by lantern light across spits of land between lakes. Anatoly kept thinking he saw faster routes, but Amal said, "No, we're following Mick." I wasn't sure I deserved his trust. A couple of times I took a wrong turn and had to lead the way back. "This water looks strange," Amal said, shining his lantern on the inky surface. There was a wind blowing, but no waves. It looked like black gelatin. The dog, thinking she saw something in his light, took a flying leap into the lake. When she broke the surface, it gave a pungent fart that made us groan and gag. Sally floundered around, trying to find her footing in a foul substance that was not quite water, not quite land. I was laughing and trying to hold my breath at the same time. We fled to escape the overpowering stench. Behind us, the dog found her way onto shore again and got her revenge by shaking putrid water all over us.
"What the hell?"
Amal said, covering his nose with his arm. "Stromatolites," I explained. They looked at me as if I were speaking ancient Greek, which I was, in a way. The lakes are full of bacterial colonies that form thick mats, decomposing as they grow. I looked at Edie. "They're one of the things on dust we can actually eat. If you want to try a stromatolite steak, I can cut you one." She gave me the reaction I deserved. After 10 hours, we camped on a small rise surrounded by water on north and south and by stars above. The mood was subdued. In the perpetual light, it had been easy to feel we were in command of our surroundings. Now, the opaque ceiling of the sky had dissolved, revealing the true immensity of space. I could tell they were feeling how distant was our refuge. They were dwarfed, small. and very far from home. To my surprise, Amal reached into his backpack and produced, of all things, a folding aluminum mandolin. After all our efforts to reduce baggage, I could not believe he had wasted the space. But he assembled and tuned it, and proceeded to strum some tunes I had never heard. All the others seemed to know them, since they joined on the choruses. The music defied the darkness, as our lantern could not. "Are there any songs about Umber Knight?" I asked when they paused. Strumming softly, Amal shook his head.
"We ought to make one."
"It would be about the struggle between light and unlight," Edie said.
"Or apocalypse," Anatoly said.
"When Umber opens its eye and sees us, only the just survive."
Their minds moved differently than mine, or any of my generations. They saw not just mechanisms of cause and effect, but symbolism and meaning. They were generating a literature, an indigenous mythology, before my eyes. It was dark, like dust, but with threads of startling beauty.